Hello, my name is Clay McLeod, and welcome to episode one of my podcast, ClayDHD. I will situate myself before beginning this podcast, and so I will start by acknowledging that I am a settler living on the traditional unceded territory of the Silk Okanagan people. But it is also important to acknowledge that I was born in Treaty 8 territory in Alberta and grew up in Treaty 6, 7, and 8 territory in Alberta. And that aspect of my land acknowledgement will become relevant later in the podcast when I delve into some of those issues. So I wanted to start out by reading a definition of indigenizing and reading a definition of decolonizing, because it is important for educators in 2023 to do both of these things in their classroom. And I am a grade 6 teacher at Spring Valley Middle School. And so these are two things that I consider to be important aspects of my pedagogy and approach to teaching and learning in my classroom. So I'll start with defining decolonization, and I'm getting these definitions from the University of Alberta Center for Teaching and Learning, and it is on a page described in the URL with the word indigenization. So decolonization is the deconstruction of colonial ideologies of the superiority and privilege of Western thought and approaches. It involves dismantling structures that perpetuate the status quo and addressing unbalanced power dynamics. It involves valuing and revitalizing Indigenous knowledge and approaches and weeding out settler biases or assumptions that have impacted Indigenous ways of being. Indigenization is a collaborative process of naturalizing Indigenous intent, interactions, and processes, and making them evident to transform spaces, places, and hearts. Indigenization benefits not only Indigenous students, but all students, teachers, staff members, and community members involved or impacted by Indigenization. Indigenization seeks not only relevant programs and support services, but also a fundamental shift in the ways that institutions include Indigenous perspectives, values, and cultural understandings in policies and daily practices, position Indigenous ways of knowing at the heart of the institution, which then informs all the work that we do. And indigenization includes cultural protocols and practices in the operations of our institutions. So I like those two definitions, so I'm going to use them as a bit of a foundation for what I would like to discuss today. So the first thing that I would like to raise or bring into the conversation is about a debate that happened over 500 years ago in Spain in a place called Valladolid. And this debate took place between Las Casas and Sepúlveda, two intellectuals at the time who were taking opposing positions. And to me, this debate has continued on into the present day. So it is still, in a way, the debate that is at the heart of colonialism and the way that Indigenous people in Canada have been and continue to be treated. And it is at the heart of what we need reconciliation for when we speak of truth and reconciliation. So the debate happened in 1550, so I guess not technically over 500 years ago, but these two debaters each took the two opposite positions, and the position that we might choose to call the good position between the two is actually not in our current way of looking at things really that good. But it was definitely the position that we would see as the more progressive of the two positions. So Las Casas took the position that indigenous people were humans. So that is the position that he took, and Sepulveda took the position that they weren't. So this debate is sort of, to me, represents a lot of different aspects, turning points, keystones in the relationship between European and other settlers and indigenous people in Canada, because often the kind of racism that is at the heart of colonialism is a racism that negates the humanity of indigenous people. And this is something that is quite apparent in Canadian laws and legal decisions, but also in the way that settler communities treat indigenous people and have treated them historically. So Las Casas took the position that since indigenous people were people, that they were humans, they should be brought into the church. So this is a theologian who is taking the position from a place of care and compassion that for their salvation, they should be shared, it should be shared with them. What he saw to be the truth of reality, that one should become Christian and gain salvation that way. And his opponent in the debate took the position that since they weren't human, they could be essentially used as slaves. They could be exploited, and it was they were to be seen as no more than beasts of burden. So that is the initial ideological narrative that Europeans brought to their interactions with the indigenous peoples of the Americas 500 years ago or so, when in the age of discovery or exploration. We're going to discuss discovery a little bit later. This is the kind of attitude or the kind of tension that has characterized the history of the interaction between European settlers and the indigenous peoples of North America and South America. It comes out in a key aspect of Canadian jurisprudence, which is sort of historically based in the approach that was taken right back to that age of discovery or age of exploration, where European explorers were going to different places around the world that were occupied and governed by the people who are or were indigenous to those areas, whether it be Africa, North America, South America, and they were claiming some kind of a right to the lands that they claimed to discover. So this is based in an understanding of international law, where there are four different ways to acquire territory for a nation. So a nation can acquire territory through discovery. A nation can acquire territory through cessation or the transfer of territory from another nation to that nation. A nation can acquire territory through conquest, and a nation can acquire territory through accretion, which is the idea that there's some kind of a natural process, like the coastline expands out into the body of water, so there's new land. So that one's kind of, you know, not particularly relevant in most cases. The notion of conquest in the post-World War II era is not seen in international law as a valid way of acquiring territory. Although 500 years ago, it was a way that nations often tried to expand their territory. An example would be the United States taking over vast parts of Mexico's territory in their war with Mexico at the conclusion of it. Getting back to the first two, because they're the ones that are the most relevant in the Canadian context. Cessation, which I'll come to when I discuss treaties a little later, is one, and the other one is discovery, or sometimes it's known as occupation. And the key here is that for a nation to acquire territory in this way, it needs to discover unoccupied land, and then it needs to occupy it itself. So the Latin term is terra nullius, which translates as empty land. And the Europeans have used this doctrine of discovery to as a foundation for their claims, both in terms of claiming sovereignty over the territories that they have claimed sovereignty over, but also in some ways as a claim to have almost like a right of first refusal to be able to treat with or to negotiate with the indigenous people that they went on to make treaties with. So just to break down the idea of discovery is there's a nation, it sends out explorers, and they discover unoccupied, empty land. And so now it's like planting your flag on the moon. You claim that land for your sovereign. During the age of exploration, it was often for a monarch, and you'd plant the flag claiming it for the king, or whatever the case may be. To claim that the lands of North and South and Central America were empty is by definition racist. So this whole idea, the whole notion that part of the narrative of European settlers coming to the Americas and discovering the land is based on negation of the humanity of the indigenous occupants of that land, whether they be the Dene in the north, Inuit in the Arctic, the Haida on Haida Gwaii, Shkwepemec people in the interior of what we now call BC, the Silk people where I live, whichever group of people that you're talking about, to say that you're discovering the land that they are living on, that they are clearly occupying, is to negate their humanity, to say that they don't matter, that they aren't agents in an ethical or legal way. And this is essentially the argument that was made by Europeans who came to North and South America and claimed land using the doctrine of discovery to justify or make their claims legitimate. They sometimes couched it in terms of critiquing the people as not being civilized or not being advanced, not using the land properly, and these kinds of things. But the narrative is essentially and unquestionably a racist, white supremacist narrative, where people from Europe were saying that their claim to discovery was superior to the claim, any claim that the people who were actually there might make. So this narrative, or this idea, this white supremacist, racist idea that you can discover land that other people live on, is the foundation for most of the colonial history of countries like Canada and the United States. So in Canada, it comes out in two ways. Land acknowledgments in most of BC will often have an acknowledgement of the idea that the land is unceded. So, for instance, we say often that it's the traditional unceded territory of the Silk people that I am living and working on in terms of land acknowledgements that people often make in this area. This is important because often people kind of let that fade into kind of automaticity. They just say it's unceded, but they don't give a lot of thought to the idea of what that means. And what that means is that the Silk people were here on this land, governing it, managing it, being stewards of this land, and then some colonists, settlers from Europe, came and started making laws and said that their laws applied, and then they started naming things and said that their names are the real names. And so we come through that process to 2023, and I live in the province of British Columbia in the country of Canada in a municipality called Kelowna, and there are three levels of government that have laws that the courts in place see as legitimate laws that govern life in this territory. But the laws and the rules, the protocols of the Silk people who were here before are not viewed as legitimate. So this is the context in which this kind of land acknowledgement is made. There's this word unceded, and it packs quite a bit of implication into it, but it's often just added as an automatic, I don't want to say thoughtless, but as a padding to the land acknowledgement. Now, I mentioned that my land acknowledgement, when I make a land acknowledgement, I think it's also important for me to acknowledge that I was born in Treaty 8 territory. Now, that comes with its own set of complications in that you're not going to say unceded in the same way that you would say in BC, because historically in treaty territories, treaties were made with the Indigenous people, between the Crown and the Indigenous people, and in some cases between the country of Canada and the Indigenous people. And in British Columbia, for instance, in the area I live in, there weren't treaties like that made with the Indigenous people. However, although Canadian law and this narrative that carries forward from the Valladolid debates about the lack of humanity of Indigenous peoples applies to this idea of treaties being a kind of cessation or a kind of transfer of land and authority from the Indigenous groups that made the treaties with the Crown and with the country of Canada. And what I mean by that is, if you consider a treaty, which is an agreement between two international bodies, two nations, two states, however, or more than two. But if you consider that, like if Canada were making a treaty with France, you wouldn't envision either one of those countries, Canada or France, giving up its sovereignty in the act of making a treaty with the other sovereign nation. If Canada agrees with Paris, or with France, I should say, to have some emissions reduction targets or something along those lines, part of that treaty doesn't also involve Canada giving its territory to France and ceding any of its sovereignty as a nation. And so even though these treaties between the Crown and Indigenous groups and between Canada and Indigenous groups were called treaties, and they were international exchanges, international interactions between two varied groups in international law. They were seen by the one group, by the settler group, by the Crown, by Canada, as being cessation or being the end of the validity or legitimacy in international law of the indigenous groups as nations and as owners or managers of their territory and as nations with sovereignty over their citizens and the territory that they governed. So often in Canadian law, it is viewed as a treaty being the end of Aboriginal title and Aboriginal rights in relation to the land. Whereas when modern nations treat with each other, when they come to agreements, it's not the end of either country's sovereignty or territorial integrity. So this also has to be looked at in terms of or taking into account the historical context of many of these treaties. So they were treaties between people speaking one language and people speaking another language. So there were translations of things like land and that kind of thing. So for instance, if you use the word land in a legal sense, it has this idea of territory and that kind of thing. But if you're using a land that translates into a word for land that translates into Cree as soil, then a question arises about whether that includes mineral rights below the surface of the land and that kind of thing. There's also the question of whether in a certain cultural framework, there is even the ability to transfer land in any kind of a permanent way, especially when people view their land as something that is intertwined with their culture and they view their stewardship of that land as an obligation that is not something that they could extinguish, which is a word that is often used in Canadian law. So there are those aspects, and then there are just these naked exploitation aspects where the representatives who were communicating with the indigenous representatives and indigenous communities making these treaties just outright lied about what the terms of the treaties were. And they would just get the people signing the treaties to put their X there. And often the account of what was explained to the indigenous people signing the treaty is not consistent with the actual words that were in the treaty. So there, the whole treaty process with Indigenous people is highly problematic. So I would argue that even though clearly there's an argument in places like Silk Territory that it is ethically important and it has implications that the land hasn't been ceded, it's unceded territory, that there are equally almost as many, if not the same number of considerations and implications about what the importance or what the relevance of treaties between the Crown or Canada and Indigenous people and groups were. So my argument is that the nations that signed treaties with the Crown and with Canada should still be considered nations, and they should not be considered to have had their sovereignty and territorial integrity extinguished, as it is put in Canadian law. So I think important thing that I wanted to really emphasize in bringing it back from this discussion of unceded territory versus territory where there are treaties between the Crown and the country of Canada and Indigenous inhabitants and Indigenous communities, is to decolonize, or to, as the definition that I shared earlier put it, to dismantle these kinds of white supremacist structures that perpetuate the status quo, that perpetuate colonialism, or the mistreatment, the unfair treatment of Indigenous people and nations, to decolonize those ideas requires us to look at the foundations of these ideas. So if the idea is that a treaty extinguished Indigenous sovereignty and Indigenous territorial integrity, we need to question that. We need to interrogate that claim. That claim is actually based on racism, is based on white supremacy. The idea that when two nations or two groups in international law come together and make a treaty between the two groups, the idea that one group then becomes subservient to the other group is repugnant. It's basically racist. So we should be interrogating that idea when it comes to looking at Indigenous territories that are under the umbrella of treaties. And similarly, when we're looking at territory that is unceded, like the Okanagan Silk territory, we should also be interrogating the doctrine of discovery, essentially. We should be saying, on what basis is this land Kelowna, British Columbia, Canada, when in fact it's silk territory? And on what basis do the statutes and legislation of these colonial constructs, Canada, British Columbia, Kelowna, on what basis are those the legitimate laws of the land instead of silk authority and sovereignty, management, stewardship, those kinds of things. So my essential argument is that to properly decolonize and to open the door for the indigenization of educational spaces, of the curriculum, of teaching and learning in the classroom, one needs to have this critical lens and to interrogate these cultural narratives, these invasive ideas that at the heart, at their foundation, go all the way back to the debates between Las Casas and Sepulveda, where the argument was, are Indigenous people humans, or are Indigenous people not human? And so we need to unpack and challenge and subvert all of those ideas and narratives in order to properly decolonize our minds and our learning spaces, and to make room for the indigenization of our learning spaces and our minds.